Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is the VFX Show, episode 13, Flags of Our Fathers. This is Alex, and we are back for episode 13, which is hopefully we'll make it the lucky episode. We've already had a little ups and downs with getting it together. It took us a little while to get back here. We've got the usual suspects with us. We've got Ron Brinkman in Hermosa, right?
Hermosa Beach, yep.
Where is Hermosa Beach?
It's a little bit south of Los Angeles Airport.
And it's very, very close to the Wayfarers Chapel.
Is it?
Do you know? You don't know where the Wayfarers Chapel is? Big glass church.
No idea.
Never mind. That's where I got married. So I got married kind of nearby. Also, we've got John Labrie, and now John, you're not in India anymore.
I'm not in India right now. No,
you came back.
Though I expect to be back there soon.
When?
With luck, in the next 2 weeks, actually.
Wow. Okay. And you're putting together a little concern there, right?
Trying to put together a little visual effects facility in India, yes.
How little is little? Everything in India is big. It's like Texas.
Well, it's going to start little and grow very big.
Yeah, I mean, you go into these. We went to where did I go? It was Maya. Have you been? Have you talked to the guys over at Maya Entertainment?
At Maya Entertainment, yeah, sure.
And you go over there, and they're like, "Well, how many students do you have?" They're like 5,000 students.
You know? Yeah.
And, yeah. and the crazy thing about in India, you have you walk in and they just the space issues just aren't the same. You know what people consider their personal space?
Yep.
It's just different than it is here in the US. And so you walk in and there's like 60 people in a room that you would normally have like 8, you know, in the United States, you know. And so it's
strangely, that's actually the way they prefer it.
That's what I found.
You find out that it's not just because, you know, they're being herded by management, but they actually like to be close to their workmates.
Yeah, when we were talking to them, I thought, you know, I was like, how could people work this way? And then and they said, well, we're moving into a new space. Here's the layout. And the layout was just more of the same. You know, it wasn't any, and literally it's like, it's almost shoulder to shoulder. It's not quite shoulder to shoulder, but it's pretty close.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, the only place I think I went that wasn't like that was probably Rhythm and Hues, which is the interesting thing about Rhythm and Hues in India is that it is it's pretty much identical to an L. It just feels like you're walking into LA. You know, there's almost no difference between the I mean, other than it looks cooler. I mean, they have this kind
of, yeah, they're trying to recreate some of the culture of the parent,
yeah,
in that facility.
I mean, they're
really smart.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's really interesting because they really that one, they're connected to the servers in LA. They really operate like they're in the same office. They're just a little further away.
Right.
So it's a fascinating thing. So anyway, so
and I just want to point out that I'm also in Hermosa and I know where the Wayfarers Chapel is.
You'll have to point it out to me next time, John.
Next time we're up in the peninsula, I'll show you where it's at.
It's great. It's It's a big glass church.
So, yeah. Is it south of Hermosa?
Yeah, it's in the peninsula, Palos Verdes Peninsula.
I don't go south of Hermosa.
He never goes south of Hermosa.
Never.
And we also, of course, we have Mike Seymour. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Alex. How are you, man?
Good. And you are in Sydney for the moment.
I am in Sydney just for the moment.
Now, when are you off again?
I'm going off on hey Alex, I got some bad news for you.
Uh-oh.
No, I don't. Okay, I'm good. I thought
I really
was bad,
wanted to start the show good. For our third time. That would be fun.
No, I'm sorry.
It'd be
that was me
right
freaking you out.
Episode 13, wouldn't it?
Hey, no, I'm in Sydney until Friday.
And then you're off to
I'm off to Germany on Friday, and then I'm in Paris, going down to Spain, and over to London, where hopefully Ron's going to join me, and we're going to be doing a conference together. Is that right?
It's looking dubious, but we'll see.
Well, it'd be good if you can make it, man.
He's given you that. He's given you the, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I know.
I'll see what I can do.
And if that fails, I'm trying to go to India to see if I can... I'm seriously trying to go to India to find John. I'm going around the world looking for VFX show people.
Exactly.
Now, what?
Where are you going in Germany?
I'm going to see the guys at 3D Equalizer. We're going through Europe talking to all of the major 3D tracking companies.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, have you played much with some of RealViz's stuff, the new movie Mento or anything like that?
I haven't played so much with that, though we are going to see RealViz. Right. Have you done some testing with that? Because that does look pretty interesting.
Actually, we actually recorded the test that they use as a sample.
Oh, cool.
That's like that. Josh is my intern, the guy that's in their sample. I made him shave off his beard just for the recording because I couldn't put dots on his chin otherwise.
And you call that an intern? Okay, that's a new word for it.
Yeah, it's really funny. Josh, you'd have to know Josh to understand. Josh is like one of those guys that if you told him to jump out that window, he'd try to figure it out. That's why we have him here. So we haven't killed him yet, but he has lost a little hair every once in a while, and we once dared him to try to drink an entire gallon of milk at one sitting, which is
well, big shout out to Josh.
Alex is creating fanatics.
Exactly. So it's all a big test, you know. So anyway, well, you should. It sounds like now. So you're talking to all the tracking companies. Is that all you're doing on this trip?
No, I've got a client in Spain, and obviously this paper I mentioned we're giving in London.
What is this conference in London?
Look, it's a interesting conference. It's a conference that's being put on. Basically, it's a link between the engineering and creative communities, and its nickname is CVMP, which stands for Conference on Visual Media Production. So the idea is that creative people in production team up with people that are behind the scenes on coding and algorithmic development to explore ways of, you know, obviously pushing the craft.
You know, I thought that they called that SIGGRAPH.
Well, you know, we're in Europe now.
Ah.
You Americans have to get used to this, that like the Europeans take this whole sort of we're not America thing really seriously.
Yeah. That's all.
Having said that, they're inviting Ron
don't
over.
Don't people so like us now that we had our elections?
Yeah, we've had our elections now. We've chosen.
Can't we all get along now?
I love you. Terrific. I love Americans to death, right? There's no problem there. I'm just saying that the Europeans tend to like to have their own thing.
Okay.
I can say that because I'm not a European or an American.
No, there's a lot of... we were talking about this on TWIM. There's a lot of things... You know, Europe... You know, everything seems to be... I don't know why. It's better, you know, in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, like European magazines. I mean, United States magazines, they're all these low line count. And, you know, the LPI is really low. And they're, you know, kind of cheap paper. And there's all this stuff. And then you get like Mac format, or you get one of these... you know, one of the computer arts magazine. It's really big, and all, you know, and the lines per inch are really high. And I don't understand why we don't get that. I guess it's because we don't care. We're not refined enough. You know,
I will say this: in the area of 3D tracking, there is one company that's not. You're like five of the six are in Europe, but there's one, Synthize, which is in America, and that's an excellent company. So
it's the effective but inexpensive choice. I think it's not.
Yeah, but it is pretty interesting that most of that research just happens to be done in Europe.
Yeah, I have very little experience. I have to admit, we use a lot of Buju and MatchMover Pro. And once we kind of settled into it, I stopped, you know, really looking around, you know, just because I can only learn so many apps at one time. So I just, you know, we find that we can track just about everything with those two apps. It's not that the other ones don't do well. I mean, I think PF Track, I think, has probably one of my favorite interfaces. You know, it's just very clean and feels
and very good at object tracking.
PF Track?
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of our stuff, because we do so much stuff that's green screen, I tend to stick with RealViz because of the being able to really do a lot of the manual tracks and helper frames and, you know, all that stuff. And then when we do stuff outside, we just do Buju because it's easy. We just point and, you know, you hit go and it's done.
So I'd be interested in what everybody else's opinion on the Zoom stuff, because I find the Zoom stuff in 3D Equalizer is really good. They all have sort of different aspects. What's the general consensus?
What do you guys think?
I haven't used enough of it lately to know. Last time I used the RealViz stuff, I hated the interface.
Right.
I think probably the one I've used most recently, the synthesized stuff, and yeah, I was really impressed with that. I mean, it was you know, fast and it's cheap. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to admit I don't do a lot of Zoom stuff. I happen to be oftentimes the person, you know, directing a lot of the shooting, you know, on set, and so I don't have to deal oftentimes with a director that wants to zoom during an effect shot, and I have to admit that I just usually put the kibosh on it. You know, when we start doing stuff, I'll move the camera all over the place. I don't have a problem with that. I just don't do a lot of zooms. I just, you know, and it's not that I, you know, I'm sure that we could, and it's something that we should do more research in internally. But to me, it's like, oh, it's going to be a pain in the neck. You know, and
Mike, who do you think has nailed that the best?
Look, it's I'll answer that question better after I've done this trip through Europe. But if I had to give an opinion right now, like, I'd say that 3D Equalizer on zooms is really good.
Right.
PF Track is really good, especially in 3.5 with object tracking. Mm-hmm. And also, I like the fact that they can do a discontinuous solution. So you could have like a nodal pan that breaks into a move that breaks into something else, and you can stitch those three together. I think Buju really, like, is outstanding. It has a particularly good system, full stop, but it's Buju Bullet. In fact, the Pixel Core version is really, really useful because it's so easy for people to get into.
Yeah.
And then, of course, RealViz, because of Image Modeler, I think has some really interesting aspects. And Alex, you just mentioned then those helper frame stuff. That's really, really good as well.
Yeah, we just use that all the time. And, you know, and I guess the hard part for me, and as I said, when it's outdoor, when we have a lot of, when there's a lot of high frequency detail and there's a lot of things that Buju is going to be able to grab onto, for us, we just throw Buju at it because it's easy. It's point and click. It just does it. We will occasionally also use, you know, Matchmaker Pro for that. We finally figured out there's a, I can't think of it right now, but that we were having trouble because we wanted to build models in Matchmaker Pro, you know, take the automatic tracking and get all those, you know, take all the nulls and convert them so that we can, do modeling in Image Modeler with the point clouds. And, it turns out that there's like a little piece of the header that you can move around a little bit there and get all that. Get that information into Image Modeler, and so we do. We've been experimenting with a bit with that, but with the helper frames, what you're dealing with is that you can. The one of the problems, if you don't have a lot of movement, if there's not a lot of movement in the camera, or if it's a pan, and you don't get enough parallax, it's really hard for the camera to figure. I mean, it's really hard for any tracker to really get that down. It can make up a lot of things, but it's really hard for it to get it really accurate. And what you can do with Match Mover is insert. You can either take photographs from other angles, so you literally just take a couple other images from a couple different angles, and then just add them as other angles as these helper frames in Match Mover, and then that gives it the other parallax that it needs when it's looking at the points. So once those are identified in those other areas, it's able to grab onto them. The other thing that you can do is what we tend to do is not necessarily do that. I find that it doesn't work as well if I use another camera. So, for instance, if we were just shooting a bunch of stuff where we had we're just doing a bunch of Pixel Core shoots actually for some future challenges, and we were doing a big. We had this 18-foot Jimmy Jib that we were kind of swinging around with the 950 and. What we did is we did one where there's nobody in frame. You could just see all the markers and we just move it a lot. And then we can use the, you know, frames from that, or frames from, you know, or we use that as a track to kind of establish a lot of the information about the camera. And we got into doing that. We were doing some work for MTV or Nickelodeon actually. And we got into just doing these big dolly shots or whatever that are just kind of the calibration frames. And we can add those, use those as supplements back to the original pieces. And we've found that to be super useful, that and as well as being able to do image modeling and then bring the models in as, you know, to be able to lock the cameras down. You can get much better tracks, we find, with that. The other thing that we're about to do some motion control shoots. And one of the things that evidently, I think Buju will do this now, and I think... I'm pretty sure that Matchmaker can, is that you can bring in, take in motion control data and use that as a guide for Match Mover and have it clean up the data. You know, so it can track from that data, using that as kind of this is where it should be mostly, but then it's going to use tracking markers to kind of refine the actual track. And I have to admit that I didn't even know it could do that until I was talking to Tim Daubert, who was one of the he's a match moving supervisor and does a lot of visual effects over at the Orphanage, and he was talking about it. So I have to go experiment with it, but that's a feature that I think is pretty exciting if it actually works. So we'll see soon. So
I think it's pretty cool that, you know, it sort of is changed. It used to be obviously you had to lock the camera down if you wanted to get a good shot. And now it's almost you want the camera to be moving more rather than less.
Yeah.
So that the solver can do a better job of figuring out exactly where it's at in 3D space.
Yeah, it was funny that I was talking to a guy who had done a lot of visual effects, you know, commercial visual effects direction years ago, and he was just getting back into the business, and it was really hard for me to explain to him that I really needed the camera to move more. You know, or, you know, he's like, "How do I make it easier for you? Do I move the camera a little?" I'm like, "No, it'd be better if you just kind of, you know, move it around." My big test, by the way, you know, for match moving is people don't, you know, it's. When you want to test a match mover, everyone does these big pans or they do these big camera moves and they want to see if it tracks, you know, and that's not really what defeats it. Usually I just pick it up and take a camera and point it at a, you know, at a linoleum floor and vibrate it a little bit. I'm like, okay, if it can do that, then I'll be impressed. So, cause
I don't know if you've done this trick of, we've done is strap a DV camera on the side of your, primary film camera and have it on wide, and even though the zoom camera is the film camera is on a fairly tight long lens, and then you just get the tracking information of where the camera was for the DV camera and offset it by the 3 inches to the optical center.
That's tasty.
But you just gaffer tape that sucker down, and I've actually done it at 90 degrees because of requirements for water and stuff that just meant there could be no tracking markers that would work. But 90 degrees off that, there was lots of fixed bits of set that didn't move, and rigging and C-stands. So,
oh, that's fascinating. I've never
once you got the camera movement, it's pretty easy to turn it around 90 degrees and, you know, work it out.
That's and then you just have to figure out the lens information and.
Yeah, but to tell you the truth, like the lens information, that was, you know, it's like one of those things where degree of difficulty 4, getting the move from all this water flying around was like -100, you know what I mean? So it was
exactly.
I could cope with it if I got the basic move, then I could work out the lens and reposition it to work.
Right. No,
you got to figure people are going to be, you know, doing a little work towards extracting stuff based on stereo information too. And so all these 3D movies are coming up, stereo movies.
Yeah, and then you get kind of built in, having those different angles definitely makes things a lot easier. One of the things we've been doing tests with is, you know, we've just started doing tests with RealViz's Movimento, which is their little motion capture solution. And you can take a couple DV cameras and your HD camera and shoot, you know, something from different angles. And one of the things that's really interesting about it is that you can track flexible objects. So, for instance, you want to have something going up under somebody's skin or along their jacket or something like that. You can put a couple dots on it, and it'll actually, you know, kind of track the surface, you know, to those tracking dots. And it's also really easy to calibrate. And that was the big thing. You just grab this box with a couple dots on it, and you swing it around in front of all the cameras, and they're able to pretty much figure out where they are really, really quickly. So our initial tests have been pretty good. A lot of it with all of this stuff, whether it's image modeling or HDR or, you know, all these photogrammetry related, you know, integration related stuff. It's a lot of it's just figuring out what you have to do on set. You know, the software is actually usually pretty easy to operate. It's not really, you know, it's not like learning, you know, something really comp, you know, like Houdini or something. It's really about knowing what you need to do on the set to give it what it wants, you know, and that just takes, you know, 10,000 mistakes, which we're trying to go through as fast as we can.
So how about that tracking on flags of our fathers?
How about that?
Since we've been talking for 20 minutes, how about we talk about the movie?
Hey, we could have some fun. We could geek out a little bit here.
Keep it moving.
All right, fine. Flags of Our Fathers, making war with VFX. So what did you guys think?
That was great.
Yeah, good stuff.
Very, very solid film. I really felt like the effects were you know, really all around. I didn't find that there were any specific shots that I thought were missing. I mean, that were missing the mark. I think it was a very, very well done film.
Yeah, I agree. It was really clean. It was, you know, everything was in there. I mean, it was a nice combination of a really good look and art direction as well. But yeah, you know, there was nothing you could point to that was, you know, bad shots throughout it, I don't think.
Now, Mike, can you give us some of the stats on this one?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I totally agree. I think it was brilliant. In fact, I'll go so far as to say it was my favorite digital domain film since Apollo 13, and that includes Titanic. I just think it was brilliant work from the guys. And I'm so glad to see Digital Domain producing such outstanding work, because I got a bit of a soft spot for the guys there in... though Digital Domain itself has had a bit of an upheaval lately, given that it's change management. Yeah. But look, the film itself was... I'm no expert on it. I certainly didn't work on it, but from what I've researched, I think it was interesting because Clint Eastwood obviously directed it, but it was Steven Spielberg that owned the rights to the story, and it was Steven Spielberg that therefore teamed up to help produce it. And for me, it was the best visual effects Clint Eastwood film, if that makes sense. And I just got to believe at some point it was either Spielberg or his guys that helped pull that off. But I think Digital Domain ended up doing about 450 shots, And the scope of what they were doing was pretty remarkable, really, because, you know, for a start, the whole thing is meant to be in the Pacific, in an island that had had the heck bombed out of it. And, of course, you couldn't go back and film at that island because it had now had all its foliage, you know, 50 years on, grow back, and there's no valid reason to bomb it again. So the whole crew went off to Iceland to film it. So, A, you're trying to make a film in Iceland that looks like it's in the Pacific, and then you didn't have any ships, and then you didn't have hardly any troop carriers, and they had like six, and the waves were wrong, so they're all digital, and the water's digital, and the ships are digital, and the whole thing looks like it's 100% in camera. So I think it was great.
I think that's traditionally been what DD was really good at, is that, you know, the environmental stuff is, you know, that's always seemed to be somewhat of their forte.
Yeah, that was
apparently.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, apparently, some of the terrain stuff was their engine software that they used. I think they developed it on Stealth. But, like, literally, when you're at the top of the rock that they plant the flag and you're looking down, that's just a big field behind. And take that out and put in a beach and an entire landing invasion force. And that's what Digital Domain contributed.
And I thought that with a lot of those wide shots, and you know, I thought that they were amazing. You know, I think that we've talked about some of these wide shots before. It's always one of those things where you look at it and you know that it's not right, but you can't figure out what it is. And it's seamless, like you look at it and there's nothing wrong with it, but you keep on feeling like it's an effect shot. What do you think, Ron?
Well, I there were definitely a couple times, when I first saw probably one of the first effect shots in there where, you know, it was an establishing shot, and you saw a couple of the big ships in the distance behind the main ship that your camera was on. And yeah, you know, there was something about it where I knew it was an effect shot, but I looked at it and I couldn't point to any reason why it was an effect shot. And so then I had to just start wondering, all right, do I just know it's an effect shot because, you know, if I'd had to shoot it, it would have been an effect shot too, and I just know they didn't have a big ship stuck out there. It's one of those tough calls where, you know, I could tell it was an effect shot. I mean, a really good one, but I could tell it was one, but I couldn't point to why.
Yeah, overall, one of the things that I tend to pick at in a lot of these, when we do a lot of these shows, is the smoke and fire. And I really felt like, other than like maybe one or two shots, they just knocked it out of the park. You know, I really didn't really feel most of the time I don't know how much was practical or how much was digital. I mean, it really just felt really good. Did you guys, did the smoke stuff work too? That's usually one of the more challenging things, you know, anything. Well, water is one, but I think smoke is, it's easy to get a consumer to kind of watch it and think it's fine. But I think if you know what you're looking for, I think it's pretty easy for most of us to pick that stuff out. And I really,
yeah, I thought, I mean, you know, it's hard to say what was real and what wasn't, because I'm sure they used a lot of practical stuff in there, but you know, there was very, very little that I would point to and say, oh, that's obviously CG smoke. I know, John, I know you were criticizing.
Yeah, I was whining about the smoke in Flyboys a few weeks back.
And that's right.
I thought that all the work that they did, I guess it's voxel based stuff that they're mostly using for the stuff here at DD, but I thought it all looked great. There was even a couple of specific quick shots that I thought looked fantastic. There's a couple of shots from inside the cockpit of planes that are strafing the hillside of the mountain.
Ah, those are great.
Yeah. I thought they looked fantastic. I mean, I thought, here's something I haven't seen before, and it's completely seamless. I'm sure it's entirely CG, but it just looks awesome.
Yeah.
And I mean, the shot design on that too. I mean, it was really great. You really felt like you were in there. There was, you know, a little, the sense of movement was good. You know, the smoke and everything, you were flying through the terrain in the distance. I thought those were great shots.
I thought that the shot, what were you talking about, John, with the cockpit shot, you know, coming up with all the tracer rounds coming towards you?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it was so funny because you're sitting there watching the guys running across, and you're like, why aren't there more planes? And then you see what it is from the pilot's point of view, and that was a brand new perspective that I had never seen. I was like, okay, that's why there's not any more planes. You know, it was probably one of my favorite shots in the whole film.
Yeah, I agree. It just jumped out, and I said, here's something I've never seen before.
Yeah.
And you've got to sort of hand it to them also because, I mean, this is... You know, for many people, and certainly my father fought in the Second World War in the Pacific and stuff. And so you're not talking about something that can be fantastic. You can't talk about something that can be... I mean, there must be a lot of people analyzing this stuff that have vast historical knowledge of the events and would really pull them up if they hadn't got it accurate. And, you know, you don't muck around with something as iconic as this because it's, you know, it's quite a serious subject. I mean, there's a lot of people... A lot of people perished, and I know this is the companion piece to the Letters from Iwo Jima, which is going to be the Japanese perspective, and I look forward to that second film. But it still has an enormous... Well, for Americans, I assume it has an enormous amount of significance, that event.
Yeah, no, it was just what I really love about, I mean, a lot of these films that Steven Spielberg is connected to, and I'm glad that Clint Eastwood was as well, is just really bringing that historical perspective. It's a film that I didn't know much about. You know, I knew a little bit. I knew that it was the second flag, but I didn't know why it was the second flag. I didn't know, you know, so a lot of these details were really interesting. And what I think that's what's exciting about the visual effects, especially when it's done well, like it is in this movie very well, is that they're able to finally tell these stories that are just really were too big to tell well, you know, maybe 10 years ago, you know, 10 or 20, you know, at least 15 years ago. It was just, you couldn't tell a story of this scale as well as you can now with what they can do with a lot of the visual effects work. You know,
and there just wouldn't have been any way to show, you know, to give you the sense of all of these ships hitting the beach. And I agree. It's nice that, you know, you can sort of bring the sense of reality to some of these things, whereas before you'd sort of feel like you were missing something.
Right.
Now, if I could make a couple of story comments. I wasn't really aware of the existence of the second film, The Letters from Iwo Jima, until recently. And I'm wondering if that's the reason that when I was watching this film, that I kept thinking that the Japanese were remarkably absent from this film. I mean, they're obviously throwing up lots of flack, and there's a couple of, I'll call them cameos, if you will, of, you know, machine gun nests and that kind of thing. But there's not really a lot of Japanese soldiers that actually turn up in this film, which I thought was a little bit odd.
Well, yeah, I guess so there's a, and Mike, you might know more about this. I don't know much about this at all. So the second one is just from completely the other direction.
Yeah, this is the beautiful thing about it, because you know, there really are two sides to every story, and this film has already been shot. The second one, I think it's the finished principal photography, and they're in post, but I'm not 100% sure on that. And it tells exactly the same story from the Japanese point of view, though obviously it's no longer centered on the significance of the flag raising, but presumably focus on the significance of the loss of what they saw as Japanese soil. And it will be interesting to see that played out, and I think that it would take a director like Clint Eastwood to be able to pull that off without... Because, you know, it's going to be pretty remarkable repeating the film, as it were, from another point of view.
On a whole other level, that sounds fascinating. Now, they didn't just do...
I think it really, you know, it probably is so much more realistic to you. There's no... If you don't have the need to sort of, you know, be politically correct or fair and balanced or anything like that, you can really... Because, you know, the American soldiers that were over there, I'm sure they didn't have any real interaction with the Japanese other than, you know, those really brief moments of hand-to-hand combat where you don't really get to know your enemy at all.
Right.
And, I think it made the story a lot more powerful, a lot more realistic, really, for what it was like to be over there.
Right. Now we didn't just digital domain didn't just work on Iwo Jima. They also had a lot of shots that they had to do that were period pieces back in the U.S. So, you know, there's a lot of extensions because, of course, these guys, you know, they get brought back from Iwo Jima and they have to go on a tour to basically raise money for the war. And so there's a lot of these huge scenes from different places around the U.S. Where they're going, where there was a lot of crowd extension, a lot of digital mats. Once again, I think just a lot of really, really great work. You know, I you know, a lot of that stuff I tend to pick at as well, and I just really didn't find a lot there to you know, it seemed like the measure between what they did physically, they didn't try to overdo what they wanted to do, you know, what they could do, you know, with visual effects. I think that they, you know, picked that mid ground to far ground and really, I think, did it really well. Did you guys like the matte paintings that were worked on?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, for me, the real contrast that came out was comparing this to the recreation of New York that they did in King Kong, mm-hmm. which you know, was beautiful work, but it was obviously designed to be you know, much more cinematic and almost fairy tale kind of thing, whereas this was you know, very, very realistic, and you know, you didn't necessarily notice the city the way you were intended to notice it in King Kong.
And one of the things that I thought was interesting about the with a lot of this stuff was that it just really you didn't feel like they were trying to step out anywhere. That was just really well done. With a lot of these extensions, you know, it was funny. I was looking, there's an article on VFX World that I was flicking through, you know, while we were doing it, and one of the things that I always notice, of course, because I do a lot of green screen, is in the last page. Did you guys see the last page where they're standing? They get up in the stadium. I guess they're in Soldier's Field,
mm-hmm.
and they're waving to the crowd. And they've got this, you know, they've got these guys standing on this piece, and they've got this blue screen on the other side of them. And then they're, you know, with the little tracking markers and stuff. And the funny thing about it is that I look at that and I'm like, well, that's just a lot of roto. You know, and I guess there was a lot of roto in this film in general, not just from the green screen, but which you know, sometimes, I don't know, I find that I can sometimes pull that out, you know, like see where that, you know, where that's happening, just because I have to, you know, I'm on the butt end of that every once in a while.
And, actually, it's the reverse of that shot, Alex, which is the only shot that I pulled up on. The reverse of the shot you're talking about where they're looking out at the crowd.
Yeah.
There's a shot from the front of looking at them. And behind them is a crowd. Now, most of the crowds in the film, as I understand it, were using Massive software. Mm-hmm. And in fact, interestingly, they even used Massive on the ships to produce intelligent, you know, constrained, self-generating movement of the ship fleet. Mm-hmm. But the Massive crowd behind them in that shot was just, I looked at it and I couldn't work out, was that, like, it's something just went, it was wrong, it was completely wrong, and at the moment I thought, oh, it's a trick shot, we're going to discover they're standing in front of a poster or something, and then it was no, it was just a crowd, and that was about the only shot that I didn't like.
Yeah, what's interesting about a lot of the, I don't want to say this like I actually did a lot of research on it, but I did do some crowd shots for Star Wars, where I had to deal with, you know, building those crowds, and one of the things that was funny was that it was much harder at the time for us to build stuff where people had to stand still, you know, like what to do with a CG crowd when they're not moving around a lot was a lot harder than what to do with them when they're moving. It's much easier for them. I mean, they can walk through each other. They can do all kinds of crazy stuff and no one notices, but as soon as they have to sit in a seat or be in one place, it seems like getting them to do something that makes sense can be more challenging, especially if you have a shot that isn't moving very much. You know, I don't know if that's been everybody else's experience, but I know that was an issue for me.
I think that's an issue just for character animation, isn't it? I mean, when you've ever had a character just stand somewhere,
apart from
the mandatory blinks, it's always hard to know what to make them to do.
Yeah, because you're just getting into all that secondary motion and all the things that we're not really thinking about when we're doing it. And I think that's definitely a more challenging piece. And I guess, go ahead.
I was going to say a quick comment on Massive, having kind of grown up around it with the Lord of the Rings. you know, we found, and I'm a big fan of Massive, but we found that once you start putting brains inside of your intelligent agents, then it becomes almost as difficult to direct them as it would be if they were regular people. and I'm not joking. I mean, you know, you really, as you know, it's you give them brains, but then you have to start telling them what to do,
right?
And why they're doing something, what are their goals for the scene, all these kinds of things, and so. There's a fairly steep learning curve on Massive, but once you've got your head around it, around the things that you need to do to get realistic behavior from your people or your objects, then other things start to emerge. A classic example, Michael mentioned earlier that they were putting brains in the boats. They were making the Massive autonomous agent boats, and we did similar things in LOTR, where, you know, we found that the best way to get a battering ram up the hill through a crowd was to put a brain in the battering ram and tell everybody around it to hang on. And so it is one of the things is that with a crowd of intelligent agents, you just you have to direct them like anything else.
Right. Now, I got a completely separate question for you. Now, there's a story that I've heard that I don't know if it's true or not. Is it true that the elves ran away from the orcs the first time they got charged on?
Yeah, there was some of the early tests for intelligent autonomous agents. I think I might actually have that online somewhere. That test. There was a simple mistake made in some of the logic, and basically the brains were smart enough to know that you should look around, in your field of vision and try to find an agent of the other color. And when you see him, run towards him, and when you get close to him, try and hit him. But we forgot to tell them that if they didn't see anybody, that they might want to turn around. They might want to look around.
Right.
And so what would happen is, like, these two crowds of agents would come at each other, and if they didn't quite spot anybody in the periphery of the vision, they'd run right through them and they'd flee the field of battle. And it was easily fixed, but it was a funny demo early on because you'd throw 5,000 guys together and about 2,000 of them would immediately just run off the field. And we used to laugh and say those were the guys that were the smartest.
Yeah. Now to get back to Flags of Our Fathers, I guess the other thing that they did when they were shooting a lot of the stuff on Iwo Jima is they really couldn't practically bring a lot of blue screens. So they really chose to rotoscope everything. And for those of you listening who aren't doing visual effects, I know we have a lot of geeks that are listening that already know what I'm saying when I'm saying roto, but just to kind of put this in perspective, when you're rotoscoping something, you are drawing a little line around a very accurate pixel for pixel line all the way around every foreground element, every frame of the shot. And it's, while it's not as manual as that may sound, I mean, there's a lot of processes that help you, it's still a very painful process. And so I guess I, from what I understand, Mike, is it 200 shots that they rotoed from Iwo Jima?
Yeah, I don't know the exact number, it's something like that. It was a lot. And I mean, part of it was just wind, right? It wasn't, you can't put up big blue sails in,
right,
you know, in Iceland.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you look at a lot of those shots, I mean, the thing to remember is that when you're watching a lot of these, for the listeners, when you're watching these shots of all those ships coming in and someone sitting on top of that mountain, you're really looking at something where everything in that foreground is all being, you know, rotoscoped, which is, an amazingly painful process in my, you know.
And it was amazingly good. I mean, you
really
know,
well done.
I watch for that kind of stuff, and yeah. It was really clean roto.
Yeah, it was exceptional. Now, do you know, Mike? Do you know what are they using? Are they using their own stuff, or are they using?
It was Nuke. Yeah, Nuke was the primary compositing backbone for Digital Domain. And look, it's an excellent, it's an outstanding compositing engine. It's very good at handling big textures. It does what we call 2.5D or sort of 3D compositing really, really well. And I think it was used to good end in this.
Yeah, no, and I, you know, that's always one of those things that, like with specialized cases like rotoscoping, you always wonder whether they're using the internal thing or whether they're using, because there's a lot of, I mean, there's some, not a lot, there's a handful of programs. Commotion used to be the big program. Silhouette Effects, I think, is kind of the one that a lot of people are using right now. Those are the ones that, because they're so specialized towards roto, a lot of people will use them. I mean, I know a lot of people who use stuff like Shake for roto and stuff like that, but when you get into ones that are, You know, highly specialized. Sometimes, you know, like for instance, Silhouette Effects is a, you know, very easy to use compared to a lot, you know, opening up After Effects or Shake or something. But I haven't had enough experience with Nuke. I think we played with it.
No offense to Ron, but just yeah, you wouldn't want to be hitting hardcore roto just in Shake.
I've seen it done.
That's not a strong point.
I've seen it done. It's a. And I don't know why, but I've actually seen, you know, some friends.
Oh, people definitely do it, but oh, you know, there are tools out there that are much more, you know, specifically targeted at the process.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And what did you guys think about the actual look of the film? Because something that I was interested in is they actually shot this on a slightly older stock. In fact, they shot this anamorphically and on a 250D. It was like 4.6, which I didn't make anymore. They actually held a whole bunch of 4.6 back for them at Kodak to make the film, and I presume held a whole bunch back for the next one as well.
I love it myself.
And then they used Premiere print stock, so they used the 2393. So the prints you were looking at were on this, you know, richer, superior, which is kind of interesting actually because it was so desaturated, yet they were that. I've normally associated that Premiere print stock with sort of richer colors myself.
Yeah, I love when movies use, especially when you're jumping back and forth. I really enjoy that look. I know it's a little bit cliche at this point, you know, where you're jumping back and forth and you have one kind of visual and another. I mean, you know, you see it in Saving Private Ryan or Traffic or, you know, all these other things when you're to tell the viewer that they're somewhere else. But when it's done well, I think it just really works. And I think that, you know, you really felt like you were watching. I don't, you know, when they were on Iwo Jima, it just felt much more. Now, were they using a 45-degree shutter or were they, do you know what they were using? Or 90-degree shutter?
Yeah, I hadn't managed to find that out. And that was a thing that I was really interested in because, of course, that was so effectively used on Saving Private Ryan.
Right. And for those of you listening, I just threw out something. You know, typically the shutter is open half the time. And if you, but in World War II, the stuff that was up there the shutter was open half the amount of time as it is now. And the reason that that's important is it made everything much more stuttery looking. There wasn't as much motion blur between the frames because you had the same number of frames, but a lot less exposed. You know, it's much quicker opening and shutting. And obviously they shot, I think, pretty much all of Saving Private Ryan, except for the present day stuff that way. And that's why it kind of has that kind of strobed look, I guess, is there. But anyway, but I there was a couple shots that I saw the guys running around and I thought that it might actually be that short shutter, but I wasn't positive.
Well, as you guys know, I'm like a big fan of color correction, and I guess that dates back to when I used to work for Cintel and Telecines. But I thought TDI did a really good job on the DI on the grading of it, because I don't like at the moment overly graded features. I think that's like, you know, the pendulum swung a bit too far, and I thought they had the grading down. It didn't look, you know, it didn't look like a TV commercial.
Right. It definitely felt period. You know, I mean, it felt right for what they were doing.
Now, it seems like everything that Eastwood does, he really knows how to stay reasonably subtle with everything he does. You know, it's nothing flashy, and it really does come back to just it's the story.
You know,
he feels no need to show off on the technical side of things.
Yeah, I doubt Clint Eastwood needs to show off in any capacity, really, does he? I mean, the man's so accomplished; it's an astonishing career.
But what's great is beyond having that is just he never feels like he never stretches any further than than what he needs to do to tell the story, which is just the way you want to do it, you know. And it doesn't ever have to be bigger than it, you know, than it needs to be. And I think that really creates a great overall film. And beyond, you know, I have to admit I'm kind of glad we had to review it. I just didn't know if I was up for another World War II film. You know, when it came out, and so I kind of put off seeing it until this weekend, and it was really definitely worth it. You know,
I feel exactly the same way. I probably would not have gone to see it, but I'm really glad I did.
And I'm glad I saw it in the theater. And if people are listening, you want to see this film in the theater. You don't want to wait for the DVD. There's enough detail and enough richness to it that, and it's a good enough film that, you know, it's worth forking out the $10 or whatever to go see it. Or what is it now in Hermosa Beach? Is it $12 yet?
It's getting there.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
I think it's about 11, I think.
I was back in Pittsburgh. It was $5.50.
Oh, stop
nice.
It.
So anyway, I think we've talked this one out.
I think that's good.
So anyway, we'll be back. We will be back next week. What do we have next week? We've got 007.
Bond.
Right? Bond. So we'll be doing Casino Royale next week. So everyone should tune in for that. And thank you very much, Ron. And Ron, where can people get more of you?
Digitalcompositing.com.
Excellent. And John, nice to have you back in the U.S.
Thanks, temporarily at least.
The whole country feels better now that you're here,
I'm sure.
And Mike Seymour, where can people see more of what you do?
fxphd.com.
Excellent.
And I just want to do a shout out to you, Alex, over the theme music.
Well, okay, here's the thing is people are going to have to, there's lots of little things in the theme music. The guys here, for those of you listening, the guys have been giving me a pretty hard time that I've been a little behind on putting theme music on VFX show. I was really locked up about the whole thing. And so it's another one of my, my great GarageBand creations. You know, for the theme music, I just want everyone to know it's, and I don't have anyone to blame except for myself for putting
it together. Is there no end to your talent, visual effects, direction,
exactly.
And now music?
Well, you know, actually, it started off, you know, when I was in 1991, I bought an Emu Emacs and Pro Tools, and one of my first things that I used to do for radio was actually do weird little jingles, you know, and the tools in GarageBand are significantly better than what I paid $10,000 for before, but I don't have any musical talent, so it really is me just kind of putting things together that sound okay, and I wanted to have it, there's a little bit of like little mystery sound effects in the background, and it was a little softer than some of the other shows that we've done. I mean, we have Ashley Witt do a bunch of the stuff for, you know, Twit, and he's awesome, and he's been pretty busy, so I put this together. People have to go up to the forum and tell me whether they, you know, whether it's good or bad.
And I want you to post that list of recommended African music as well while we're on it.
Oh.
You're not getting off the hook that easy, man.
Okay, here's the problem is like I can give it to you, but you can't buy it outside of Zimbabwe. That's the real challenge right now. So I'm going to have to figure out. You know what? I can probably put links. It's probably on zimaudio.com. So for those of you listening, once again, Mike, I was talking on the phone with Mike, and I talked about how much I love African music and I listen to a lot of it. And then Mike wanted me to send him a list so he could get some from on iTunes and the problem, you know, and then I said, oh yeah, I'll put it right together. And of course I never did. And, but a lot of that had, I actually went and found it. It was just that there's none of it's in iTunes because, ZMC isn't carried on iTunes. And so I'll put that list up. I'll put it up somewhere where everyone can find it. How's that?
Excellent. Thanks, man.
So I'll do it. Okay, here's the thing. I'll put myself out on the line. I'll at least put up the list of the music by the next show.
Okay.
Now I'm publicly
on record.
Yeah, public record. So I'll put it up. I don't know whether you'll actually be able to find it, but if I can, I'll let you know. And I'll just tell people where to look for some of this stuff, and then they can try to find it or not. But it's good stuff. It's good to work. You know, this is to get back into VFX. African music is exceptional for working on shots because you can't understand what anyone's saying. And so you don't get caught up in the songs, you know, and I find it much easier to concentrate when listening to good African or good Brazilian music. Anyway, that's it. I think we're done. So until next time, keep it real.
Keep it real.